And then after that, Justin will speak for 10 minutes or something, and then we'll hand off to you, and you'll do whatever it is you do.
What's his name? Jim Brown?
Yeah.
That's right.
He won't be here to speak to.
Hello, okay, testing. Hello, 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 hello.
Or you can just pop it up and say, this is it.
Are you seeing the queue? Good audio there? Yeah, you're seeing.
So they'll turn off.
Great, that's good. Cool.
Yeah.
We'll be able to meet staff through them.
Well,
here, a piece of paper. I could write on it here, press left or right, to make sure they don't press on the keys. If no, that's fine. But it might make them less confused. Can I show you any trick? Whips do what they're supposed to do. So here is my nice, friendly iPad. I'm going to take this. Lemongrass. There we go. Lemongrass. And bloop. Now I can move the mouse cursor around the screen there. So I have to
do that. How do you do that?
It's VNC. The VNC part on here. So when the time comes, I can just flick back and forth with their slides.
So why don't you do that? So that they don't have to press the keys.
That's an interesting thought. So you can use them. They can press the keys. Left and right is okay. They're probably fine.
That's very clever.
Yeah.
When did you think of that?
This morning, I thought, cool. So. So, good afternoon. We are reaching the end of the show here. The goal now is to have the work-in-progress session. The goal of the work-in-progress session is to allow a series of clowns to come up on the stage and entertain you briefly, but also perhaps inform you they're not all clowns. Essentially, the format goes as follows. Each speaker has 5 minutes to do with what they like. I would suggest they spend 3 minutes talking to you, and maybe leave a minute or two for questions, or even finish early, given that we have a lot of speakers. But if they try to go over 5 minutes, then we will remove them from the stage. So, we'll see how this goes. The first person who's going to come up is John Baldwin, who's going to talk to us about three different things. So he gets 1 minute slide. Speakers, if you've sent me slides, you're in alphabetical order by last name. So that will give you a rough sense of when you're going to go. So, and speakers also use the left and right cursor keys to move through your slides. I know it's confusing, but you'll figure it out.
Do you have your secret mouse cursor ready?
I do.
All right. So, very quickly, the first slide I have is about upcoming release schedule for FreeBSD. We're just getting ready to start the code cycle for 8.1 release with code freeze this month sometime, hopefully soon, and aiming to release around July. For 7.4 release, we're tentatively planning to get it out around October of this year. If that goes well and smoothly, then 8.2 release will follow about 4 months after whenever 7.4 release comes out, so tentatively around February of next year. And as far as 9.0, we think that we'll start the cycle with code freeze and all that type of stuff sometime in the summer of next year, about a year away. Then the release will go a while after that. Okay, some things that aren't really scheduled. When I was here last year, I was hacking on some various VM stuff to add support for different cache modes and page attributes to our VM that was long on the feature list for the NVIDIA AMD64 driver. And since that time, it has all gone into the tree, and there's now a public beta of the NVIDIA AMD64 driver. It's been out for a while. All the code is available for you to use that driver in 7.3 and 8.0, and the driver's in port, so if you install the port, you automatically get the nice AMD64-friendly driver. I've actually been able to build 32-bit Linux binaries using CUDA and run it on a FreeBSD box running AMD64 successfully, so it has at least the compatible bits for 32-bit Linux CUDA binaries to run with, like, a Tesla card. It works fine. Also, the APIs that were added to support page attributes and stuff, the DRI maintainer in FreeBSD, Robert Nolan, has added support for some of that to the DRI drivers in FreeBSD and head, and in fact, the ATI driver now commonly uses write combining mode to disable cache snooping, which adds a little bit of performance boost as well, similar to the same stuff that NVIDIA was trying to do. Finally, one of the things we're going to try to get, we're going to get it into 9.0, is NUMA support. We had a pretty good extended discussion about this in the Dev Summit, and some form of NUMA will be available in 9.0. There are currently some out-of-tree patches, so we've already made some initial, very rough progress, but we're targeting to have something in the tree that at least does generic round-robin application, or round-robin allocation, meaning that different memory allocations get spread across domains and kind of spread equally to amortize the cost of remote versus local memory. That we're mostly targeting doing NUMA on x86 class machines, which currently have a relatively low performance penalty for going for remote memory, which kind of determines what kind of strategies you use. You typically don't have to be quite as worried about migration as you would on more classical systems where it takes bloody ages to get to remote memory. And finally, once this kind of initial stuff is in the tree, we'll then work on perhaps more slowly on refining additional APIs to allow userland or different system administration tools that in specific dedicated cases where your workload can benefit from having purely local memory, we can allow that to happen. Questions?
That was lightning fast. Thank you very much, John.
I was trying to keep up with Robert.
So Henning next. So we're going to swap. So we have only one speaker who was unable to provide PDFs to go onto one notebook.
See,
what do you mean,
works? I promise the switch over is fast. So I'm Henning. I'm the OpenBSD monkey. I'm going to give you a quick update on what I think is cool stuff going on in OpenBSD. One of the biggest things is what we call PMEM range. The problem being attacked, 32-bit only devices mostly, and memory above 4 gigabytes. DMAing an AMBA from above 4 gigabyte to a 32-bit only device is obviously not going to work. There's a hardware solution called IOMMU. Works perfectly fine on Spark 64. Unfortunately, on AMD64, the IOMMU, at least on the early ones, is shitty, and the early Intels don't have it at all. The really, really new ones are actually not so bad anymore, but yeah, that's future work. So everybody else's solution is bounce buffers. The extra copy is pretty stupid and slow. So our solution is called PMEM range. There are still cases where we'll have to bounce buffer, but this will be a rare exception. Basic idea being allocate the memory where it's accessible for the devices that need it. So this is deep in UVM and not my area. Consumers of memory basically define their constraints. So for AMBA allocation, we'll add a constraint that says, this has to be below 4 gigabytes. Actually, it'll be below 2 gigabytes for another reason, but this is beyond this talk. And everybody who does not define constraints will just get memory above 4 gigabytes to save up on this this precious resource below 4 gigabytes. The basic PMEM range is in, all the low-level UVM stuff. The consumers do not define the constraints yet. There are probably bugs hiding if they would do. So this is work in progress, and I'm not making a prediction when this is done. Might be next release, might be another. Page attribute table support, they are a bit remotely, this is not really precise, like MTRs, but way more flexible. One reason why we have to do this is that the MTRs on modern machines are almost exclusively bullshit. And with PAT, these machines get write combining, which is very important for frame buffers that speeds them up a lot. Like, it's a very, very large difference. GCC4. There's ongoing work to switch some of our GCC3 architectures. The GCC2 architectures are kind of stuck. Like, these are the really old ones. There's ongoing effort to switch them to GCC4. It's a giant struggle. I spare you the details. Every GCC rant you ever read is probably true. Promising there are considerable performance improvements on Alpha, which is a surprise to us, on AMD64, which is also a surprise, but less so. And Mac built on i386 is about 30% slower than was GCC3, but a big part of that is that building GCC4 is actually a lot slower than building GCC3. Xsight, the DRM memory bench for Intel graphics, which means fast, accelerated DRI2. This is kind of interesting. Only Linux and the firewall operating system, OpenBSD, have it. Radeon is going to follow soon. In the meantime, we support some newer chips, including DRM support. And in general, RX is in a very nice state because everything is pretty much up to date and working fine, which these days is not all that common. Hardware support is many, many drivers and lots of device additions. There's a new platform, Longson, which is this Chinese MIPS-alike thing. Actually, nice hardware. There's OpenBSD on Palm. That's another new platform, HPPA, and Avignon, which is a weird platform most of you will never see, support SMP now. SGI, also now supporting SMP, by the way, works on almost all of the more recent SGI machines. Well, recent. ACPI, we don't have the Intel ACPI stack, right? We have our own. So suspend and resume are almost there. There are a few hooks missing in some drivers. The most annoying one right now is the disk driver, AHCI. We'll get there. On some machines, it works fine already. The installer got improved a lot. It's pretty trivial to install OpenBSD now. A typical install is just entering the hostname, root password, and pressing enter otherwise. There's routing domains, virtual routers, basically. Very cool, overlapping address space and everything. Very cool. BGP and MPLS support. The big networks need that. Many little things that further improve PS performance. By now, it's roughly 3 times faster than the very old version that the other BSDs and Apple actually use. Well, yes, PF changed a lot. We introduced match rules, which do not change the pass or block state of the packet it's matching on. We split scrub into packet reassembly and the other shit. And packet reassembly, by this, is only a button on or off and on by default. And the entire NAT code has been rewritten. It's much faster and much more flexible. Otherwise, in the network, MCL get I, auto-sizing of the receive rings for network cards, which makes a machine survive the worst DOS you can imagine. IFconfig has an option to turn off IPv6 shit on an interface-per-interface basis. PF is on by default. There are improvements in ICMP filtering almost done. And there's much more cool stuff I cannot talk about because my time's out.
Everyone give him a round of applause. That was very impressive. It was very impressive.
Thanks.
So, Dan, we're skipping Jim Brown, right?
Yes.
Okay. So next is Michael Dexter, who would like to talk to us about BSD Fund. And can you keep up with Henning? Anyway, left and right. Yes.
Okay. Michael Dexter, BSD Fund. And I'll start with a news flash at this very minute in Rostock, Germany. In a NetBSD developer's home, there is a hackathon going on for MDocML, which is a very lightweight tool to replace GROF in the base systems and all the wonderful things that go with GROF and C++ code and such. There is a Google Summer of Code project to include PostScript support in that tool and also include it in FreeBSD. And I'll just hint that it's taking place at a NetBSD developer's house. And if Apple gets on board, GROF should be in ports, hopefully, in 6 to 12 months. So, BSD Fund in 3 slides. BSD Fund is a very low-overhead program of Linux Fund, and it uses an affinity credit card to raise money and some direct donation programs, also called capital programs in traditional philanthropy speak. I approached Linux Fund to set it up several years ago, and ended up as a program manager. You can read into that what you like. And we've picked up a choice domain name that does not include Linux in it, and we can discuss that later. So the card does not compete with, say, grants from the rather impressively wealthy FreeBSD Foundation, which is doing some excellent work. In some of our conversations, we've looked at, well, there are always grants out there, but how do I become a jerk quicker than taking a grant from someone? So this is a new source of funding that is basically what you see is what you get. Instead of airline miles, one can generate a small amount of money towards an event like this. And please raise your hands. Who spent over $1,000 to get here? Okay, quite a few. And there's money at the sign-up time. And with this conference and perhaps your next conference going through the card, there instantly is a basic grant to the next BSD CAN, the largest North American, absolutely critical BSD event. So thank you, Dan, for your excellent work for many years on this. There are a few numbers of where that money goes and how we'd like to route it this way. And the very first effort of BSD Fund was to help out with the portable C compiler. I've heard repeatedly this week the theme of the tool chain, the tool chain, the tool chain. Somewhere out there we need to find more companies and institutes and universities that will employ full-time people to work on tool chain. Will the correct tool chain stand up? Will the correct BSD stand up? I don't even want to go there. It's all good. And as for this work, Anders has patches flying, and there is a lot much testing to be done. Once SSA is in place, I'd like each and every one of you to throw your favorite code at it, see what breaks, submit bug reports. And finally, if you are a Linux dude or dudette hanging out there and you are using open source software, please pick a foundation. There are about 70 of them, and I compiled the first list of them. Support it. If you don't support us, go support another one. Thank you. Any questions?
Justin Gibbs. Yes.
So Xen is a very interesting, exciting hypervisor that allows you to do some really cool things. At Spectralogic, we're building a platform that takes advantage of Xen, FreeBSD, and some Linux components in order to build our product. So here's a block diagram of what we're trying to achieve, and I think this is actually a very exciting thing to do. Xen is the glue at the bottom, the hypervisor. We have OpenSUSE 11.2 as our DOM 0, the control domain. That basically hosts a web server, so we don't really care that much about it. All of the storage in our storage appliance is managed by the box in the middle, the storage domain, which is a FreeBSD AMD64 VM running in hardware virtualization mode. One of the features that Xen provides is the ability to take a hardware resource, a PCI resource, and actually pass it into a domain. So that SAS controller at the bottom, which is an LSI logic controller, is actually owned by the middle box. He gets almost no overhead in accessing it. The only overhead that occurs is in the emulated PCI configuration space, which has to go through the blue line through the control domain. So why would you do this? Well, imagine a product where the end customer has something that is not FreeBSD, is not Linux, is something else that can be run in full hardware virtualization on Xen. Well, that's the guest domain, the gray box on the right. So we take a customer solution, we put it right there on the storage, cohabitating the same physical machine, and we use Xen to give them seamless storage access to all of our storage, which is managed by Spectralogic and its management applications. The storage is actually managed by ZFS in this picture. So what is in our storage domain? Lots of boxes. We spent a lot of time looking at hardening Xen and also FreeBSD support in Xen. When we first looked at it, this was the state of the system. All the boxes in orange had bugs. The red box block back, which is the mechanism that we use to pass storage to other domains, didn't even exist. The status right now on AMD64 with HVM looks more like this. There are still outstanding issues in a couple places in the system. In order to be able to support exporting of services to other VMs very, very efficiently, we need to take advantage of the IOMMU. IOMMUs, just like MMUs on CPUs, require TLBs. Those TLB entries have to be flushed when you decide to change mappings. And of course, mappings, unless you do something a little bit more intelligent than what is happening right now, have to be managed or flushed with every single transaction. When you start doing hundreds of thousands of transactions a second, it gets kind of expensive. The other thing that's missing or still problematic with the Xen hypervisor and FreeBSD support is timekeeping. We tend to lose time. And there's some interesting work going on right now to address that. Lastly, NetFront on AMD 64. That is, in the Xen model, you have back-end drivers that live in a domain that's willing to serve resources to you, and front-end drivers that live in the consuming domain. NetFront is the front-end driver for network operations. In AMD 64, actually, most likely these bugs exist in I36 as well. There are several problems with TCP segment offloading and some of the management of the transmit descriptor rings. We're still working on solidifying that, but in the next couple of weeks, I would expect that to be in pretty good shape. My particular, the company that I work for is not that interested in paravirtualized support of the VM layer. So the current status on FreeBSD is that full paravirtualization, where the VM system is aware that the system is being virtualized, is only available on I36. And even the I36 support is too new to actually run on the legacy API that is being used in Amazon EC2. So in summary, I36 PV is functional, has been functional for some time. AMD 64 hardware virtualization is being hardened for production environments. The company that I work for is very interested in that, and we're also working with others, commercial and volunteer, to make that true. But we're still looking for more contributors to help with PV, and for those interested, getting Amazon EC2 support, and then eventually being able to replace that Linux domain zero with a FreeBSD, native FreeBSD domain zero controller.
John Hickson.
So I've been working.
Very small.
Yeah.
How do you?
All right. So I've taken Chris Moore's installer for PCBSD, and I've written a curses front end for it, and I rolled an ISO for FreeBSD. I modified it a little bit, and it currently will install FreeBSD with ZFS root, mirror, RAID Z. It does GPT partitions. You can script it. We're going to use it for FreeNAS, and if people are interested, we can do more work to integrate it with FreeBSD. Any questions?
Deeply impressed with our speakers so far. So, Rick Macklin. On his way.
Okay. You probably can't see it all that well, but it doesn't. Basically, I've been working on NFS v4 for BSD for some time now, and I was told to try and create an alternating picture. It didn't come up very well. But in any case, like any sophisticated software project, you need a lab environment, and that's mine. That office doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, give you a little tour of it here. That guy is a Pentium 166. It was running OpenBSD 2.6 when I started this project. So as you can tell, it's been a work in progress for some time. The OpenBSD port made it to 3.something, and I just don't have any time to work on it any longer. That's a G4 PowerBook. The screen no longer works. I got it in trade for some other old junk I had, because you can drive an external VGA port off it, but you can't actually see it. I used that to port the client side of the NFS v4 to Leopard, started with Tiger and then Leopard, and it works out pretty well. About 1,000 people have downloaded that. And if you're interested in that, it's on Google Code under Mac NFS v4. Unfortunately, it doesn't build for Snow Leopard because they changed the rules for kernel extents linking, so it's kind of dying too. The third case, which was in this box and a laptop down in here, is FreeBSD8 and current, and it's working out quite well now. It's inside. It was inside 8.0 as an experimental alternative. There were some problems, but they're mostly resolved, I think. And for 8.1, it should be pretty solid for NFS v4 client or server. It doesn't have a couple of the more exotic features like extended attributes yet or referrals, but otherwise things seem to be working pretty well. That, by the way, that little binder is the RFC. It's slightly less than 500 pages. The new minor revision is now out, and it's larger. When they go from 4.0 to 4.1, I think it's 600 and some page RFC. So it's quite a complex protocol. Any questions? Okay, I'm out of here.
Alexander Mutton.
So existing ATA implementation for FreeBSD served us for about 10 years. It was planned and made for hardware, existed 10 years ago, and at this moment it required quite significant changes to support new features such as NCQ, port multipliers, and other things. This feature required significant changes and was decided to not reinvent the wheel, but use existing one, in face of CAM subsystem, which already implements many of existing algorithms. Oops. So here's old existing CAM subsystem scheme. So, and here, what's it become now? The main change was to split generic code from SCSI-specific and then add equivalent ATA specific code for parallel and serial ATA. Also, several new drivers were written, HCI, MVS, and SIS, to handle new hardware. ATA driver, old existing, was split into half and partially wrapped to serve legacy hardware. So here you can see supported features. So new drivers support all existing features of the hardware. All legacy hardware also supported by wrapped legacy driver, so nobody lost. Everything works. Here you can see performance benefits that can be received because of using common queuing. On some workloads it goes up to double, but 20 or 30% is quite real on the usual workflow. Port multiplier also could be used quite effective, and for hardware supporting phase-based switching, it's almost gives the same number of transactions per second than direct attached drives. Sure, raw bandwidth can be a bit less because drives share same channel, but for more cases, it's still enough for the moment. SSD drives also benefits from this, from using NCQ because of reducing command latencies and hiding them. So now all the code present in 8 stable branch, it's quite simple to use it. In basic case, all you need is just to load several modules. And, to completely migrate from old ATA subsystem, you just need to rebuild kernel and add options ATA CAM option to enable ATA for wrapper. So the main things that wasn't implemented yet and doesn't have alternative solution at the moment is ATA RAID 4. So if you're using booting from a striped array, at this moment it's not supported, but it should be done before this infrastructure will be enabled in next release. So the goal is to enable this subsystem into had before 9.0 release, and I think it quite realistic. So code is already present, it's used by many people, and quite stable, and welcome. If somebody have any feedback, welcome anytime. Thanks to IX System for supporting the work, and many people for testing. Questions? Thank you.
Rui Paulo talking about 802.11n.
So this is going to be really quick. I just wanted to say that we're working on 802.11n. And basically, for those that don't know it, we're working on AMPDU, which is basically frame aggregation. And we have AMPDU working partially on Eteros, and we're still working on the transmit side of AMPDU. Recently, we also have AMPDU receive side on the Intel stuff, and the Relink also has a new driver that is probably going to hit the trees sometime this year, and that driver has full 11N support. Basically, the Intel stuff and the Relink drivers do AMPDU on hardware, so it's straightforward to do it, but Eteros does it on software, so we're still working on that. Besides that, there's much more to 802.11n than just AMPDU, but we hope to work that in the future, and hopefully we'll have a great 11n implementation for FreeBSD9. Any questions? Thank you.
Thanks very much. Doug Bratson.
Hi, I'm Doug Rapson. For some reason, I've been spending my time writing a debugger. It's a GDB, more or less GDB compatible debugger with a BSD license. So why bother? GDB is too difficult to work with. It's 400,000 lines of code. It's more than 20 years old, and I just can't make myself work in it anymore. There's got to be a better way. I decided I'd have a go. And I like writing new code rather than modifying someone else's 20-year-old code. So I've got some goals, what I want to achieve with this. This is basically what I use in GDB and not what anyone else uses. I want a command line debugger. I like command lines. GUIs, maybe, but I'm not going to exclude them. I use operating systems which use ELF and Dwarf and pretty much nothing else. A.out's not interesting anymore. I debug local programs with ptrace. I debug local programs that have crashed with core files. I debug kernels and remote programs with the GDB remote protocol. More goals. I use programs with shared libraries, threaded programs using thread local storage. I use C, C++, and sometimes D. several platforms would be interesting within a single debugger, so you don't have to have 10 different cross debuggers. So I want a system where you can have multiple targets supported in a single debugger. Anything else I haven't thought of yet that GDB does. There's some things that I don't want to achieve in this. I don't want to support obsolete file formats. I don't want to support obsolete platforms that don't exist anymore. I don't want to support languages that I don't use. I don't want to support... When I say platforms here, I mean targets like remote debugging protocols that no one uses, file formats that no one uses. Generally, I don't want to support the 20 years of cruft that has accumulated in the GDB code base and try and pick out the features that everyone still needs. Any questions?
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Language? Sorry? What language is it going to be written in?
It's written in a language called D. You can search for D on Google. It's an interesting language.
Thank you, Doug. Is D short for Doug? Okay. Julie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jean Ridoux from the University of Melbourne, and I have a strong interest in clock synchronization. I'm working there with Daryl Veitch. I've been working on this project for the past 4 years, so I'm not going to attempt to explain everything. Going straight to the point, we work on this project. It's called Robust Absolute and Difference Clock, so in short, RAD Clock. The main goal of this project is to provide an alternative or replacement to NTPD and PTPD, potentially. The key difference is that NTPD and PTPD are designed above feedback kind of approach, where we are using a feed-forward approach to design the synchronization algorithm. So in short, the advantages are that we provide a more robust absolute clock. We can create a difference clock. You can ask me questions about that later. We do some kind of voodoo magic, you can replay time, which is a kind of foreign concept from a lot of people. And we have a simpler footprint in the kernel, which is a simpler kernel support, and which allows us to do some interesting work on Xen and some kind of virtualized system. So you would say, why is that important, or is it important, actually? So I'm going to show you a couple of plots to try to convince you that, yes, it's an important piece of work. Here we can see some error of the different clock synchronization algorithm running on one computer. In red, we have NTPD, and so you can see that over a couple of days, then it accumulates error in the millisecond range with some nasty oscillations, and hopefully you can see that the dark line in the middle is very close to zero, and below the 50 microsecond range is what we achieve. Very often I get the question that is, well, okay, NTP is all, yes, NTP is not working very well, but there's a new alternative that is called the IEEE 1588 protocol with all the precision time protocol, and there is a software daemon that is available on Linux, and I think George is trying to port that onto FreeBSD. Good luck with that. So you can see that if you don't have dedicated hardware, well, basically what you will get is like this gray, massive, spiky clock error on the top. And if you can't see that, sorry for the poor choice of color, in blue, just centered on zero, this is what we achieve with the exact same condition. So there is clearly an improvement in terms of performance. Another slide point on this 1588 protocol. Here we have a quick experiment where at this point in time, we can see the first big arrow. We disconnect the network, we reconnect the network. 2 hours later, the clock has been diving by 200 milliseconds. It's a bit nasty for a protocol that is called precision time. So just to conclude on that, our feed-forward approach requires very few kernel modification. So we have a working prototype for a couple of years now. It has been tested for the past 4 years. We are into trying to achieve good performance in here, so we are a bit picky. We have a project that is supported by the FreeBSD Foundation to make this a generic support and push that into the kernel. Clearly, the product will be ready by the end of 2010, and we hope to ship that hopefully with FreeBSD 9. Here's my email. If you want more information, contact me later. And this URL gives you also the software to download if you want to try, and send me feedback and bug reports. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm new to BSD, so it's a pleasure to be here. I'm actually here to talk about the software that we've been using to record the talks in the various rooms. So you've seen us been lurking in the front row here. FreeCR, we call it a portable presentation recording station. The vision for FreeCR was basically to have software that we could put into a backpack, so laptop, microphone, camera, or VGA capture device, as we're using here today. Have it be very, very easy to use. So basically, one button to click start, one button to click stop. Not too hard to configure the options. Currently, it's supported on pretty much any Linux you throw it at. It'd be nice to have it supported on various flavors of BSD. We have somebody working on a Windows port right now. It looks like this. So as you can see, there's a preview window that shows whatever's being recorded. This was actually a screen capture from a talk this morning. On the right-hand side, there's a live audio feedback, so you can tell that things are working the way they're supposed to. There's a button to hit to stop and record. So this was actually in the middle of recording a talk. What's kind of cool about it is that you can teach FreeCR ahead of time about the talks at a conference. So there's a little drop-down list of the talks. You don't have to scramble and type them in at the last second, which is kind of handy. So in terms of evolution, we've been doing this for a while, I guess a couple years now. When we first started, it was, we would do events not unlike this. And something dawned on us. We said, well, geez, if we didn't record it, all that great talk, that great knowledge, it disappears. And people will remember, yeah, that was a great talk, but it's not available for reference, and people can't build upon it in the future. So initially we started paying somebody to record. That was a really bad idea. I don't recommend doing it. We got ripped off badly. Then we said, okay, let's license somebody else's software. And that was better, but it was still very, very expensive to do. So we developed FreeCR. FreeCR is licensed under the GPL version 3. Sorry, it's not BSD, but it's very similar in terms of trying to keep it free and available at low cost for people. It worked, which we thought was awesome. We recorded a bunch of big conferences. We're now currently on FreeCR version 2. It's pretty good. And as you can see, we're working on ports and translation to make it more international. And we have both branches for branch for that and a branch for streaming. So we look to add live streaming as well. Basically, the workflow is you set up your laptop, microphone, VGA capture device. It takes less than 10 minutes. When we first started doing this, it was a mad scramble for about an hour and a half to do it. You record the talk, which is basically just pick the talk from the list, hit the record button, hit stop at the end. You tear down at the end, which takes about 5-10 minutes just to pack up all the cables and put it back in the backpack. You throw it on your back, you jump on the bus, you go home, nice and easy, and you can take it on a plane. You publish the talks later. It's using free video formats, so basically AUG with Vorbis and Thera. So you can use pretty much any video hosting platform you choose, which is kind of nice. So you're not locked into anybody's proprietary stuff. This is what it looks like here today. So we basically got the VGA output going through this device, and we're recording the VGA signal as well as the microphone. You can also record with the camera, so either FireWire or USB. You can also record local desktop. So if you wanted to screen capture and you don't want to buy the hardware, you can do that as well. The architecture, it's built on Python. It uses Qt for GUI widgets. We use GStreamer for the video engine. And it's fairly portable, so we're hoping that we can make it available to people on other platforms. That's basically it. It's a pretty easy going bunch of folks working on it. The code's in GitHub, and there's the rest of the information there. In particular, if you're interested, the @FossLC Twitter address and Identica address is actually @FossLC and Identica as well, is where we'll announce the videos from this conference and any information on FreeCR if you're interested. Thank you. Any questions?
Quick question.
Yeah, sure.
I noticed the video preview looks a little unstable.
There's a Mac here, and I'm not sure what's going on. I'm going to debug it after, but this is the first time we've had this problem out of, 400 or 500 talks, so okay. Probably something to do with the video settings for this particular machine, so... Any other questions? Cool. Well, thank you.
Kevin Van Dyke.
Hi, my name is Kevin Van Vechten. I'm going to be just giving a quick overview of LLVM as a hobbyist who's been following the project pretty closely. So what you can see here is LLVM is really attempting to implement an entire compiler tool chain. Starting at the top with the front-end parsers, there's Clang, which is entirely new to the project, and supports C, C++, Objective-C, and Objective-C++. There's also the more mature LLVM GCC project, which uses the GCC 4.2 front-end, compiling all the languages that GCC front-end supports, and then feeding it into this middle layer, which is the LLVM engine. The LLVM engine is actually pretty mature at this point. It's got some nice optimization and code generation. It was, I believe, pretty much founded around experimenting with link time optimization as the major focus. And then, of course, a compiler only gets you so far. There's also the language runtimes that go along with it. So there are other related projects to LLVM, which is libcompiler.rt and recently announced libc++. Both of these aim to provide compatibility with libgcc and libstandard C++, respectively. But all of this is under University of Illinois open source license, which is very similar to the BSD license instead of being under the GPL. And so the best way for you to get involved, and I spoke to Chris Lattner briefly before coming here, and he says they're very excited about the interest that FreeBSD is showing in Clang. Hopefully many of you saw the talk about Clang BSD earlier in the week. But the best way to get involved is really to try it out, to try using Clang to compile your own code. Maybe you can try compiling FreeBSD base or ports in the ports collections, and file bugs on anything that doesn't look right, quite right. You know, if there's GCC extensions that it's not parsing correctly, they want to have full GCC compatibility, so definitely let them know. Also, the architectures that they test most heavily are Intel and ARM, as you might imagine, but there is support for other architectures, and so any testing you can do on those other architectures and bug reports you can send back to the project will be very helpful. If you're actually looking to help out by contributing code to the project, they are very interested in people who do want to submit patches for the various architecture support, and they're especially interested in patches for improving the ELF support in the new machine code backend for LLVM. And they're also at the URL on the screen. There's a bunch of larger projects if you're really interested in getting involved with development directly. And that's it.
So I will exploit the situation to give my own work in progress, but I will set the timer as well. So I want to talk to you very briefly about Grand Central Dispatch, or GCD, that some of you may have heard about. This is a framework for concurrent programming that was released by Apple along with macOS 10 Snow Leopard. It's convenient, it's efficient, and it does task-level parallelism, which means that instead of programming to the Threads API, use an alternative API in which you provide blocks of code that are running synchronously or synchronously. They run as a result of I/O events, timers, and that kind of thing. And the principle is to unify management of events from the operating system and synchronization and run them all in task in queues, which are essentially similar to threads in that they might be serialized or they might be concurrent. And the operating system provides threads, and the library just kind of takes care of all the details underneath. It is Apache licensed, it's quite an interesting thing. I thought I'd show you a little bit of code just for one moment. This is Hello World, or at least Hello World twice. If you wanted to run Hello World asynchronously, then you might just call dispatch async. It uses a language feature, which essentially are closures in C, and you can run the code there. And interestingly, it's a closure. You can refer to a variable that's actually in the calling scope, which is kind of interesting. And you get a copy of it that's read-only in the asynchronous context. You can also run things synchronously. What's interesting about synchronously, of course, is that if you have a serial queue, you can use it for synchronizing access to an object because you run all the blocks of code that modify that object synchronously in the queue associated with an object. So you can use it to synchronize access without using locks. And then at the end, we run the main routine. And of course, it's multi-threaded. The operating system provides threads every time you decide you need a little bit more concurrency. Maybe when latency and scheduling is getting a little bit too high, you might inject another thread. I ported it to FreeBSD from macOS 10. We announced this in September of last year. It does currently require the Clang compiler because it uses a C language extension. This is the closures feature for C. Patches are in macOS 10 to support blocks on GCC, but we have not ported that patch over to FreeBSD. FreeBSD 8.1 will ship with all the required kernel features, but if you check out 8 stable today, you can use dispatch on it and it just works. So that's kind of neat. I have one last thing to tell you about, and that's an announcement we made a couple of days ago. I've adapted the Apache web server to make use of GCD. We provide a new NPM. Instead of using threads or processes, you can use the GCD module. It takes about 1/4 the lines of code of the equivalent code when you're using threads or processes. Basically, it hides all the complexity of managing work and distributing it over threads and processes. So that's a pretty powerful feature. It is experimental code. This can all be found on the web. If you go ahead and Google, you'll be able to dig it up pretty quickly. So, any questions?
Jennifer?
Hmm?
How